Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with Andy Lipson. And hi, Andy. For our listeners that are not seeing this, I'm in the state of Florida and I'm on a Skype call with Andy. So I hope this turns out well. And we apologize in advance if the sound quality might be a little bit echoey or some other technical difficulty that might happen in place.
Eduardo, Eduardo's going to sound a little echoey and maybe like a little computer synthesized voice. It's robot, cyborg Eduardo.
We are trying our best. And I'll try not to laugh heartedly because otherwise it'll screech people's ears.
I can take care of that in post-production.
All right, let's begin.
Yeah.
So, on today's episode, we will be discussing the strike, the General Motors strike that the workers went on over the weekend. And it began, most workers went actually on the picket lines on Monday. So,
I think they started like Sunday night, right? Something like that.
Yeah. It was the Saturday negotiations where the expiration was the deadline, no? On Saturday night. Yeah. And that midnight is when the syndicate leaders decided to go on strike. And they had been preparing for this as well. They had some fund, strike fund that they had been doing, they had been saving up for. And so here we have nearly 50,000 workers going on strike, and this is the longer strike than the one they had in the GM strike that took place in 2007, the year before the 2008 recession economic crash.
Right.
And that was, again, if we just remind some of our listeners and viewers, that the 2008 crash was also the year that the federal government bailed out the auto industry,
right?
And it was before the financial crisis,
right? And
so,
and there were two sets of can I get some details there?
Please do, yes, Andy.
And
yes.
There were two sets of giveaways. I mean, there's been decades of giveaways in the private sector. The private sector unionization used to be as high as it was in the public sector, of about 35%. Unionization, and it's now down to 6 or 7% unionization, and as well as in the auto industry, they've been losing more and more jobs. In some cases, it's to jobs going out to the south, jobs going to Mexico, jobs going from northern United States to southern United States, leaving the country. But a lot of the job losses have been due to technological efficiencies, in which people's jobs are being taken over by essentially by robots or by efficiency measures, which has reduced the number of people you need to produce the cars. But in 2007, they went on a two-day strike. But there was major giveaways during that time. That was the first introduction of the two-tier system, was in 2007, in which incoming workers were going to be paid significantly less than the workers who are currently having their jobs, as well as that was the first time GM workers were going to have to pay about 3% for their health care. Then in 2008, when the economic crash happened, the GM, all the big three, basically used that crash as an excuse to get a big bailout from the government, as well as forced concessions on their workers. In the case of GM workers, they were forced to eat an additional, four plants were closed, I think. Wages were pretty much frozen. And the 8-hour workday was gone. So that many times they would have to work longer than 8 hours in order to, like, they were, instead of hiring people, you would have people work extra hours. It's been, and all of this was done supposedly to get Chrysler back on its feet. I mean, I'm sorry, GM back on its feet. Mm-hmm. And GM has posted, $27 billion worth of profits in the last 4 years? Yeah, I think $6 billion per year on average. So GM got more than back on its feet, and workers are trying to basically scramble back and get something back from all the work they've been doing.
Yeah. And let's remember as well that in 2009, when concessions were being made for GM, the workers decided then to sort of not allow, well, they didn't decide to go on strike, and they didn't decide to make more demands on GM that was potentially going to be bankrupt. And as one of the workers said, I was reading, was that they were trying to not make these concessions on GM that so that they wouldn't so that the GM could maintain itself afloat in 2009, and they are just feeling that that same favor is not being reciprocated now, now that GM has actually increased their profits. And that's one of the sentiments as well. I was looking into. What do you have to say?
Honestly, I believe.
Why are you shaking your head?
Because I think GM and the big three auto companies got over on workers. They basically, the government at that time was passing out billions to banks. I mean, trillions to banks. And I think GM saw an opportunity to get essentially a $51 billion handout from the government, as well as forced concessions on its workers. So I actually believe GM, I'm not saying they were fine, but I think GM cried poverty because they saw an opportunity to extract billions from the government. And the government was fine to go along with the lie because they're the capitalist class.
So essentially lying to the workers.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there was some kind of, but you know, Hostess declared bankruptcy, closed their gates for like literally 3 months, and then they came back up and became new Hostess again. These capitalists, mm-hmm. they have all sorts of ways of coming back from the dead if they want to.
Yeah.
So I think they basically used the cry of poverty and the crisis that had taken place in the context of the government bailing all these, like, oh, we don't want to be Lehman Brothers. They were saying, don't be Lehman Brothers. Otherwise, it's going to cause a larger collapse on the economy. That was the threat. I don't think the government was fooled. I think the government was complicit in basically saying, yeah, we're going to give you a massive payout, and you're going to, but the conditions of doing that are the workers have to take some rollbacks, and workers went along with it.
Well, I just, and to give a figure, over that decade since, it was the GM has increased its profits, making $35 billion in the past 3 years. So I just wanted to insert that.
I think I'd see $27 billion in 4 years, and you're saying 35. So that's like $10 billion a year. But either way, they've made multiple billions of dollars per year.
And, I mean, even though many of those plants have also been slated to close, little of that money that has been increasing went into the workers' paychecks.
Correct. And again, this is something even our school district will do. Oakland School District did this. Is as you go enter into like, look, GM is making billions of dollars, not just in revenue and profits, right? That's what they take away, and that's what they retain for themselves. And the GM entering into what they know is going to be a difficult contract round. Even Wall Street Journal was saying workers are very well may actually reject the first contract that is agreed to by the union, because they're basically getting a sense that auto workers have just kept on taking it and taking and taking and aren't just going to take anything anymore. So I do believe that GM is doing the same thing that Chrysler Fiat is doing and Ford is doing, basically saying, we don't have the money, we're going to threaten plant closures. So then workers will basically not ask for wage increases, not ask for benefit increases, not ask for the part-time workers to go away, and basically say, oh, okay, well, if you don't close the plants, we will ask for less. So they want to basically use the plant closures, the bosses want to use the plant closures as a bargaining chip to drive the demands of the workers down. Because bosses don't just want to, like, here's what the bosses have said. We'll give you a 2% wage increase, but your healthcare cost is going to go from paying for 3% of your healthcare to 15% of your healthcare. Plus, we want to expand the part-time number of part-time workers. Temporary workers.
We want to expand it
from 7% to up to 50%, from what I heard.
Yeah.
And we're going to do plant closures. How does that sound like a plant, like a company making $6 billion a year, or maybe $10 billion a year? No, it's that's them basically, again, playing hardball and trying to drive the demands of the workers down.
One of those demands that they want to end the pay and benefit divisions between temporary and permanent employees.
Well, that's the workers' demand, right?
And increase job security.
Right.
Right.
Right. I was speaking of what the bosses were offering, just to be clear, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I see. Do you have the demand, the list of demands that I have a few of the demands that I just sort of recollected.
Well, let's just be clear. I was talking about the boss's demands, and I think then you switched over to the workers' demands, and I don't want this to be confusing those things.
I see. I apologize. I didn't mean for us to. Yes, you're right. I meant to say that the striking workers, they personally want to end the pay and benefit divisions, and they want to make sure that they have job security as well as better medical coverage, and just being paid the same thing as the people who are doing the same job, alongside with them. They feel that even the temporary workers that are working alongside with them, many of them have families and many of them have the same sort of background as they do, but yet because of this temporary versus permanent worker status, it makes a distinction between them.
Right, and they're all, well, the other thing that workers are asking for is to not do the layoffs that are come as a result of a lot of these plant closures that are being proposed. So they want the benefits, they want their benefits to increase. They want to pretty much eliminate that. Well, they don't want to eliminate the temporary worker. They want to reduce it to 90 days. Right now, there are workers who work there up to 8 years or 9 years, I've heard, who are still called temporary workers. And they make half the wages that just the work that any other worker does. They make virtually half the wages. And this is one of the ways that the bosses, the GM, bosses have basically made their profits.
Now.
Oh, because they don't have to pay benefits, too.
Now, I'm only going to mention Trump, not because I'm trying to go off on Trump mania here, but he is the president of the USA, so I will say that I just imagine what it must feel like for him that he is divided here between, you know, the auto workers or largely a lot of his base, and yet he's also trying to cater to GM Motors. I mean... He didn't say much on his tweet, but he just said that they should make a deal, quote, unquote.
Well,
So I think he's playing and treading very carefully around this and not saying directly what he, where he stands with it.
I think Trump will.
That's my suspicion.
Yeah, my suspicion is he's going to come in and try to basically stop the plant closures or reduce the plant closures. And he's going to claim victory by saying, I saved U.S. jobs, but then he's not going to do anything for the temporary workers. He's not going to do anything really for the benefits. He's going to give them a piddling wage increase, and I think it's going to be, if Trump comes in, that means he's collaborating with the GM bosses. It probably also means he's collaborating with the UAW leadership, and honestly, even the Democrats, like Biden and Bernie Sanders have basically said, don't stop these greedy GM corporate heads. But they're not lifting a finger to do anything to help these workers. And the workers aren't going to be able to rely on the Republicans, on Trump, on the Democrats, really even on their own UAW leadership, which only recently was basically being investigated for embezzlement and money laundering, I think, and misuse of funds for, junkets and prostitutes and just all sorts of things you would expect from Wall Street brokers as opposed to. But one of the things that that UAW did back, I think this was actually back in 2004, might have been 2007, is they essentially tied some of the money that the UAW makes to the profits earned by GM. And that put them on the board of directors of GM. So you had a UAW person on the board of directors, basically you had a union boss making sure that they were profitable, and profits really are about the exploitation of workers. So it's a complete conflict of interest. And then recently they were shoved off the board, and so even that little plan didn't work.
Now, when you say not even the Democrats are doing anything, I mean, I'm just curious, what would you ideally like to see, or what would you think that they should do? I mean, just you said they're not lifting a finger.
At the very least, if you're a Democrat and you're Bernie Sanders, you should basically be calling for the other rest of the auto workers to go out on strike. You should be calling for other teachers and all us working people to join them in that strike. At the very least, you would at least say that. And basically call for as big a shutdown as you can in order to support these workers, because that's what it's going to take. And you would highlight the fact that workers in Mexico right now who are being asked to do a speed up, GM workers in Mexico, I think it's in Silao, Mexico, S-I-L-A-O. How do you see?
Are you talking Sinaloa?
I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Sinaloa, okay.
I think so. Mexico.
Yeah.
Those workers were being asked to do a speed up to make up for the loss of product coming out of these 45 or 50 factories that are shut down across the Midwest and East Coast. And they refused to do it. So that is what international solidarity begins to look like. And that is ultimately what these workers are going to have to look to. They're going to have to look to other striking workers with Ford, with Chrysler, Fiat. And at the very least, you'd expect a socialist, a progressive Democrat, so-called progressive Democrat, to be pointing that out and actually trying to get helping workers generalize this strike action to get urge more of us to do this.
Now, we decided to talk about this strike in particular for this episode because instead of talking about the attack in Saudi Arabia or the whistleblower that's happening right now and under the Trump administration and or other things, because here on What's Left, we have considered strikes when we have interviewed teachers for strikes, and we have interviewed parents involved in supporting teachers to change their schools. We have already discussed in the previous episode where socialists see strikes as an instrument to be able to leverage and demand as a form of a way to demand from the elite class what they would like to see in their society. Mm-hmm. If anyone, I think, would be listening to this or viewers, I think that I just wanted to give some context of like how some of the strikes in the past have showed that they have produced results, and even though they can be painful for workers, but they do tend to produce results. And I should mention, by the way, that I was very disheartened that GM yanked away the healthcare benefits this week from the workers, and that was a little too soon. And I think that sort of was caught the union off guard when that happened. I was just reading that happened, and that's really sad to say. But they took away their healthcare. So going back to this decision to strike, it's a very serious issue, and it really requires a collective plan to withhold labor, and I think that when we look at these recent strikes, such as the Marriott hotels or the airline or the teacher strikes, well, those are recent, but just historically, they have produced results, and I think you might argue that they haven't done enough, though. But
I think they're important. I mean, first off, one of the reasons, you basically said the biggest reason we're talking about it, because it's the most important thing that I think can happen is for workers to go on strike. It is the sign that workers are taking part in a class war that is always going on. Like in 2007, there was class war. In 2008, there was class war. Even when workers don't strike, there's class war. It's just a one-sided class war. It's just the capitalist class slugging away at us, taking and taking and taking, extracting profits, extracting wealth from our labor. A strike is the one time, is the best way for workers to say, we're going to engage in this battle and we're going to fight back in this, in what is a constant warfare, which is going between two classes that happens under capitalism. So it's very important. I think actually this GM strike, it's been interesting to see how little it's getting covered in many ways. A lot of people don't actually know that it's taking place, even though it's gigantic news for 49,000 private sector workers.
In 9 states in the USA.
Yes. And
9 states, yeah.
And it's a big deal. And I think the cards are stacked against them, but the fact that they did this is surprising to me. It's the third strike now that I was like, they're not going to do it. They're just going to negotiate. They're going to use a negotiating tactic. And I was telling you, it's time for me to realize that something's going on. It's not like we're going onward to victory, but there is something happening within the U.S. working class that it is starting to no longer just take its beating and not fight back. Now it's fighting back. Fighting back does not mean you don't get beaten up. Fighting back just means you might get a few blows in on the other person, and you might learn how to fight. And then you might actually later learn how to take your opponent out.
Andy, why have you been cynical about it? I mean, I think that just in the past few years, we've seen more and larger strikes, even in so-called red states. Right. I think public sector employees, most notably, right, the teachers, and as well as the private sector workers, like I mentioned, the airline and hotel, grocery and ride hailing industries have showed recently that these are there are workers getting together collectively to demand from their bosses.
Right.
Why is it that you think that
part of it is just,
and even Kaiser is considering it, right?
Yeah. Afterward. And you know what I was going to say? Well, Kaiser's considering it, but they're not going to strike. And now I got to stop saying that. I got to stop with that, right? I think I'm going to stop saying it. I hope I'm going to stop saying it, or at least you can say, Andy, I thought you were going to stop saying that. But let me, that's a good question. First off, my own union has time and time again beat this drum and then not done it. And I followed ILWU, so many different unions, SEIU, and different. I have followed different struggles and even gone and tried to support different struggles and heard union leaders over the last 10 years talk about fighting back, use tough talk, and then they never deploy their forces in the way they need to. So I've gotten used to that. Also, I think, I was part of an organization who believed that when the economic crisis hit in 2008, this was going to be a gigantic explosion of struggle and working class struggle and things like that, like the 30s. Many of us thought it was going to be like the 30s again.
Yeah,
I think there's a misunderstanding we have, and it's something that actually Marx does talk about, and I think Trotsky talked a little bit about this, is that often, and I'm reading Rosa Luxemburg again, and she mentioned some things that indicates this, is workers don't necessarily fight when the hammer comes down and when the economic crisis hits. That shocks workers almost as much as it shocks the capitalists. And capitalists are able to get over on them during that period. But often in the recovery phase, after workers have given and given and given, is when workers start to say, wait a second, when's there going to be some comeback? And that's when some of the struggles really start to pick up. And I think we're seeing that again here. So I think there's a reminder that crisis doesn't necessarily bring struggle, but sometimes the recovery from the crisis is where the period when the working class starts to get back on its feet again and remembers that it needs to fight to get what it deserves.
And what about, I had one question that I had talked about with someone else. What if, this one is a question that from, what are the other options? What what other options does a worker have if a strike does not meet the demands of a worker?
I mean, what other options?
If the workers are not able, so there are these strikes that's happening, right? And if the workers are not able to have their demands met by the executive, by the administration, by whoever's at the top of these companies. What other options do these workers have?
You have no option other than to drive their profits deeper into the ground. There's an estimation that GM is, I've heard anywhere from as low as $100 million per day to $400 million. Although it's going to start to pile up because parts are being made in that plant that are needed in other plants, and so this is going to, if they can stop that scabbing operation that is being started by GM,
yeah,
workers have to escalate their own things, stop the scabs. They have to basically try to expand the strike so that, like currently, the very same crappy deal that's going to the GM workers is coming to other UAW workers, the people who are in the United Auto Workers Union, at Ford and Chrysler. Another 100,000 workers could be going on strike right now because they're about to get the same crappy deal that the GM workers are being put on them. UAW, in order to keep itself from losing the strike, needs to mobilize those workers. All right. And secondly, they have that strike fund you said that they reserved. That used to be a $1 billion strike fund only 15 years ago. It is now a $760 million strike fund. It hasn't been reduced from striking because they haven't been doing that. It's been reduced from the union pulling money from that thing in various ways to basically pay out itself, pay out the bureaucracy. So if you took $760 million of that strike fund and just said, look, this is our war chest, we're going to war, that basically puts almost, I did it just off the $15,000 in the pocket of each striker to basically say, you got $15,000, see if we can stop the work. So you drain the coffers of GM and drive them into the ground, and you threaten them basically with almost losing everything by eliminating production, so stopping production, and threatening to expand the struggle, and expanding the struggle. So you have to bring the company to its knees. You know, so it's not an ask, it's a demand. You know, so that's how it's class war. War isn't about asking. When you go to war, you don't say, well, would you be willing to give up? You have to pummel your opponent, and that opponent has to be feeling like they're going to die. And that's exactly what that's why it's not unfortunate what GM is doing. GM understands what they're doing. They're making their opponents suffer. They're going to torture them. They're going to make them threaten. They're threatening their children to say, if your children need health care, maybe your children don't have health care right now. And GM knows it. So they're not, this isn't something that they, oh, we don't understand how we're doing the workers. They are like, yeah, this is class warfare. We're going after you. We're going after your family. That's what GM is saying. Workers have to have the same sense of determination, and we have to treat our opponents bitterly, you know, just in the same way that they will treat us.
And the public should support these.
Well, they will. I mean,
the public should definitely, because if the public does support the strikes, and the strike has more leverage.
It does.
The unions have more leverage. Yeah.
But strikes are not won just on, are not just won on public support. This strike will be won on stopping scabs, on stopping production, on expanding the stopping of production, and yes, use that war chest to keep your troops in the battle.
I wanted just to point out a figure, some numbers. I think the Gallup has asked since the 1930s whether individuals approve or disapprove of labor unions. In 2018, public support for unions had risen to 62%. That's roughly the same as it was in 1970, up from 2008, low of 48%.
Right.
Most people have fairly positive opinions of organized labor, with an average more approving than disapproving over the past decades.
Yeah. And I think it has, the approval of unions has grown with unions actually fighting back. Most people think, oh, like even teachers will say this, we don't want to inconvenience parents, we don't want to inconvenience the community. People are looking for somebody to be fighting back, and fighting back in a decisive way. And this is the most decisive way for workers, for people to fight back, is as the organized working class. People get a sense that this is now a real battle. Even though the number of workers going out is still relatively small, and they are isolated in relationship to the forces they're arrayed against, and this struggle will probably have to expand if they're going to win. But no doubt that there is And I think it's one of the reasons why the mainstream media is really not talking about it a lot, because I think they know this would garner a lot of support. And that support will help, but that's not ultimately how this is going to be won. I don't think it's going to be in the same way that people talk about that way with school strikes. This is going to literally be won as a point of, I think it's going to be won with making GM suffer to feel like it's going to lose so much profit and so much money that they have to give in. You have to make them give up.
And I'm watching closely the Uber and Lyft work drivers that are attempting to form a union.
Yeah.
Which the companies don't really want them to. They've been sending messages on their apps trying to discourage them from supporting certain legislation, from considering them as employees instead of contractual workers.
Right.
I do think that there are many sectors, whether public or private, there are so many sectors that don't have unions, and they should start forming unions. Yes. And I did find something here where states with higher rates of union membership are also more economically equal.
Yeah.
So it just makes sense to have workers organize themselves and to have unions. I do think that though it will be a struggle for the drivers in the state of California to try to organize, but we'll see. We'll be watching. Because that's a long lucha, a struggle.
Yeah. Well, and this strike that's happening right now is connected to the wave of strikes, like you said, the teacher strikes that have gone on. I think there were also strikes in Canada and in Mexico recently, around auto strikes there. So this is connected to something that's happening in this country and part of that wave. And this strike does have the possibility of encouraging more workers to join unions or form their own unions, giving them a sense we have to join that battle. I think Wall Street is aware of that. And what I had heard is that Wall Street is essentially threatening with lowering the status of GM stocks if they aren't able to settle in their favor. That is, not in the favor of workers, but Wall Street is already threatening GM to basically say, you better defeat these folks, because I think the capitalist class in the United States is worried that this kind of strike stuff can become contagious, and they don't want that.
Yeah.
So they are going to demand, and they're going to get behind the GM bosses winning this thing, if not decisively, winning this in a way that will make GM workers regret that they ever went out, because that's what Wall Street wants to see GM do to them.
I have a question from a listener, if that's all right.
Is it a listener from Florida?
Yeah.
Is it a listener from Florida that I know?
Yeah, I do. Yes, it is. Here it goes. I'm trying to incorporate some of the listeners and viewers with their own questions that they might have.
Yeah.
Here it is. Aren't administrators, executives, CEOs, business owners, workers as well? What distinguishes them from the working class? For example, here's, according to CNBC, allegedly Elon Musk has worked 120 hours a week and slept on the factory floor. Would he not be considered a worker just as well?
No, not within, I mean, you can do work just like farmers do work, but they're not part of a working class. They're at least peasants, you know, like a person who's on their own farm does work, but they're not part of a collective class. The working class are the people who only can make a living by earning a wage. That is not how Elon Musk makes a living. Capitalists don't make most of their money through wages, even though, what's the woman's name? What's the GM boss? It's a woman.
Oh.
She's making $27 million a year or something like that. You know, so they make outrageous wages, but that's not what makes them capitalists. What makes them capitalists is the fact that their wealth is generated through their ownership of all the places, the factories, the tools that these workers are allowed to use. And they basically say, you can come into my factory as long as I get to steal from you every minute that you work for me. And that theft is in the form of profit, because that profit comes from the fact that the worker is not getting back the value of their labor. And People don't know this, but despite everyone thinking that the U.S. working class is in such a better position, more likely than not, I've seen some numbers that basically say the U.S. working class is one of the most exploited working classes in the globe, meaning that the level of wealth that they generate compared to the amount that they retain for themselves is way lower than other working classes, not just in other industrialized countries, but in even, you know, so-called third world countries. And So the level of exploitation in this country is super, super high. And exploitation is basically theft. And that's what makes a person a capitalist, is the fact that they make their money through that theft and not wages.
Okay. I think when, especially if we're not familiar with Marxist terms, it could be somewhat, sometimes there might be misunderstandings of how we consider what is the working class and what is the elite class in this system of the hierarchy. I do think that that sometimes it's debatable who belongs in the middle class. Remember we discussed about this, like if we consider doctors, if we consider people who make a certain amount of money, but they're still not in the top 1% or even 10% of the population. It's still hard because they still make some amount of money that is profitable.
I mean, Marx's understanding of this isn't in any way connected to wages. It's except to say that you are a member of the working class two things. If you have a collective self-interest in producing things, and that is true for all workers, that's the only way they're able to make anything, is by coming together as a collective to make anything. And secondly, that you the only way you can make a living is earning a wage, because the means of production have been stripped from you. You no longer own anything except, you know, the wages you can earn if a capitalist allows you to work in the factory that they control like a dictator. Middle class, the petty bourgeoisie. So that's the bourgeoisie who is at the top, the capitalist class. What is called the petty bourgeoisie is the managerial class, the people who often are they're not capitalists, but capitalists hire them to manage workers' work. And if your work is being managed, then you are probably a member of the working class. A lot of doctors don't have themselves being managed, and so they more likely fit into a section of the petty bourgeoisie. And if you're not in a place where it's like you working with other people, if you're just self-employed, you're a member of the middle class, the petty bourgeoisie. Because you kind of you're not in the real battle lines that exist under capitalism. The real class division that decides the future of our future as a species, really, as a humans, is the situation between the capitalist class and the working class. What happens as a result of that battle, because that battle's always going on, even if working class doesn't want to engage in that battle, the battle's always going on, is going to decide our future. Do we have a socialist revolution, or is there the common ruin of contending classes? Do we see civilization essentially ruined to the point where socialism is not possible? All of that gets decided by what either the ruling class, the capitalist class, does, or the working class, internationally.
Well, hopefully, then, with whatever is going on in the air in the USA, then SFUSD UESF will decide to participate as well, and with the movement the labor strikes.
I do think there's something happening, and win or lose, this is important, what the auto workers have done. Because if they win, that's great. And if they lose, not as good, but they learn. The only way we as a class will learn about who we really are and what we really are, the only way they really learn about the importance of internationalism, the fact that those workers in Mexico are supporting them right now, and those workers in Mexico are being demonized. Don't come into our country. We're going to kick you out. You know, no, we have to see that the only way we're going to win is by seeing them as our brothers and sisters. You are welcome into our country. We're welcome into yours. We'll organize you. But that solidarity is not just a solidarity of kindness. It's a solidarity of trying to exercise our power as a class to defeat the capitalist class. That's what the source of that solidarity is. It isn't just a moral kindness towards workers in Mexico or workers in Brazil, even though it could be animated by something. It really is a solidarity that I think mostly will be forged out of the need, out of the necessity of fighting our bosses.
Mm-hmm. Now, the only thing, too, is also making sure that our unions are not as corrupt. Yeah. I mean, well, you just mentioned something about UAW. I mean, you're right, officials in the UAW have been under investigation and accused of misusing union money. And just as you pointed, some of the strike fund.
Yes.
That's where our unions fail us, and we could really harm workers who decidedly go on a strike.
Well, I've been trying to change my language in my own union, because I will often say, what's our union going to do? And I'm talking about our union leadership. And I need to stop saying that, because the fact is, something the union leaders always say when they basically want to make an excuse for why they're not going to do something is they say, well, you are the union. You all are the union. All you members of the union. It's not me. You are the union. Now, they don't actually believe that, but they say that when it's convenient for them. But the fact is that is actually true. The fact is that the 49,000 workers who are going on strike are the union, and they actually have the potential, if they were organized enough, if they are militant enough, and if they were prepared to stop scabs, to organize themselves, to not listen just to what UAW says, or at least the UAW leaders say, and do what needs to be done in order to win the strike, then they have much better chance of winning. The more independent they make their struggle, the less they make their struggle about doing what their elected leaders say, because now their elected leaders are corrupt, definitely. But I think our elected leaders aren't even close to that corrupt, but they're going to behave the same way. They're going to tap down struggle. They're going to do just the bare minimum. I don't think UAW is interested. I think UAW is interested in having a 1 to 2 week strike. That's it. Even if they have the money to go much further. And one of the things they're doing is they're not starting the strike fund, which is $250 a day. $250 a week. Mm-hmm. $250 a week versus $2,000 a week being made by UAW employees. But that $250 a week strike fund doesn't start until next week. They're not even getting paid it right now. So what kind of battle plan is that? That's like you're already trying to basically take the weapons you're taking food out of your troops' mouths and say, well, I'm going to starve you for a week and then I'm going to have you fight next week. Makes no sense. Mm-hmm. You want to give them all the money. You want to give them money now, give them confidence and say, we'll give you each, a lot of the coverage I've been seeing is, and this is another thing, is a lot of the left websites that I usually cover aren't covering this. But the World Socialist website, which I will show some articles, has been doing a good job. And they have said that workers should be demanding $750 a week. And I think that's right. Wow. I think that would be much more doable. And it still doesn't even take that
for much nearly 50,000 workers.
So. Yeah. The fact is, like I said, if you take $760 million and divide it by 50,000 workers, that's $15,000 per worker. $15,000, not $1,500, $15,000 per worker. They could live off that for quite some time. What is this strike fund for? What are they saving it for? This is what it's for. It's for this war at this moment. But UAW leaders don't see it that way. They want to use that strike fund to defend. Partly that strike fund is going to be used to defend themselves from all these legal problems that they've got themselves in.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of SFUSD, UESF, excuse me.
Yeah.
I want to keep, all I want to do is I'm looking out for Uber, Lyft workers, as well as the 80,000 Kaiser Permanente workers that are set to strike, we'll see, on the 14th of October. And I would like it for it to be mentioned, but it's not going, I mean, at least I haven't seen it on catching any airtime on the presidential debates.
No, I don't think it's going to be talked about at all, or barely anything. And again, the Democrats are only going to give it that lip service they give it, which is we're for a fair deal. We're against those greedy bosses. We're for a fair deal for UAW workers, and then they don't lift a finger, they don't say anything to actually say, well, how are they going to win this? How are they going to get that? Are you going to give them any guidance on this? Nor do I expect them to. They're capitalists. Why would capitalists tell workers what to do, like to help themselves? You know, so the Democrats are going to feign like they're friends. Trump is going to play this little. Trump's going to come in and try to make a deal, and he's going to claim that I saved U.S. The GM jobs, but it's going to be a crappy deal in terms of what I think it's not going to affect the number of the temporary workers issue. No capitalist can be relied on to save the workers here, and that's just a law. That's not just this struggle; that's every struggle, and we'll have to do it ourselves.
All right, and I think we should look for a way to wrap up.
I do too. I think this has been a good episode, and thanks for bringing the questions. Thank our special friend for bringing his questions as well. Oh, I said him.
Yeah.
Who knows? It could be a she.
Well, I will try to incorporate more listener and viewer questions. Yes. So yes. I think it's only fair.
Anything we want to take away from this?
I'm looking into strikes more. I'm thinking of more of how workers can always leverage their find leverage in their demands.
But I will also say that we've had discussions about identity politics and privilege and things like that. And this, I feel like these moments when if you look at some of the pictures, I mean, it's multiracial, it's cross gender lines, you know, men and women fighting together, in solidarity. It is this moment, it is this sort of struggle that actually is the way we're going to end sexism and end racism. Not this specific one, but it's out of these sorts of struggles through which the bonds of real solidarity will be forged. It's going to be through warfare that we will find out who we truly are, and that all these other things of being different colors and different genders, different sexual orientations are meaningless with regards to who our real allies are. And if a person is willing to fight, anybody's willing to fight together and struggle, I think that is the way these divisions get dissolved. Now, if you want them to stay dissolved, you have to eliminate capitalism. But these are the ways. It's not just about the kind of language you use. It's your willingness to fight side by side. Language can matter, but it's your willingness to fight side by side and not give up with your fellow female employee or fellow black employee or fellow white employee or whoever. That is how racism and sexism is going to ultimately be truly challenged in this society.
I agree. Well, that was a nice note to end on, Andy.
Good to see you. Yeah.
It's great to see you. This brings me back to my routine every week. It's been nice being here as well. It's a humid and yet nice weather and stuff different. Yeah.
Any thoughts for next week?
What could we discuss for next week? There are the climate strikes that students are participating in every Friday since, especially since this Greta Thunberg, I think, is a figure now. That is, because she came from Europe, across the Atlantic. We could discuss something around that. It could be that. It could be opioids. There was Purdue Pharma as well. They just did something legally to get themselves out of a bind.
I also think if something develops around this, what's happened with Saudi Arabia and the bombing of the attack on the refinery, that might be something worth discussing. So there's a number of things we could do. But we'll see you next week.
All right. And it is. Let me end with where people can find us in such first. Please, anyone could subscribe, rate, review, or best of all, share with your family and community on any of our five platforms on BitChute, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes Podcasts, and YouTube.
Yeah.
Please write, again, subscribe, rate, review, and you can also comment on any of the YouTube videos below. Thank you very much, and this concludes our episode for today.
All right, see you next week.
Ciao.